Gallagher's gonna have the news.
It is Monday, May 18th, 2020. The longest year. There's no way into this that's not, like, we should start saying the day. We should start saying, like, day 62 or something.
Oh,
like
that's
that.
A great idea. What is day one? Like, the 16th, March 16th-ish?
I think it's around, I think actually our stay-at-home didn't go into effect maybe then a few days later.
For me, it was actually when the NBA got canceled.
Which was?
I don't think I've been outside since.
That was the week before, right? Wasn't that, like, the Friday before or
something?
It was
a few days before, yeah. For sure. And the last time anyone was in my residence, actually, the lockdown began for me officially when Scott left my house after the emergency podcast when the Mitch Englander charges came out.
Yep. That was it. There was no going back.
And then we recorded another emergency podcast this week when a second guilty plea emerged for a consultant named George Chang.
Third guilty plea.
A second guilty plea in the Jose Huizar case. We'll do an update on that later, but please just listen to that episode. It's much, much too long for us to cover, even summarize in this episode. Happy birthday, Scott.
Thank you. It is a low-key quarantine affair. I did curbside pickup for the first time. Which was...
I should have known.
Pretty smooth.
When you said you were doing curbside pickup at the Container Store, I was like, what's the occasion? There must be something.
You went to the Container Store?
Yeah. I figured, hey, I'm 30 now.
Yeah.
Might as well start acting.
Get organized. Get serious.
A building exploded. Do we want to talk about that first?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Everyone's okay, it looks like. Or everyone is expected to survive.
Everyone is... alive, right? There are 11 firefighters who sustained some injury in this major fireball explosion. If you're anywhere in the, like, proximal radius to downtown, you probably saw this yesterday. There was an enormous fire that started in the warehouse district in, like, the part of downtown that borders Skid Row. Basically, it was 3rd and Central, I think. So this is a part of downtown where there are a lot of wholesale distributors for various goods. If you've walked through there, there are, like, a lot of head shops and, like, vape supply stores and things like that. It's generally speaking a pretty rundown area. And as I said, it's, like, right on top of Skid Row. So yesterday, firefighters at the Skid Row fire station that we've talked about previously...
The busiest fire station in the United States of America.
In the United States. We talked about it pretty recently because at the LA Times, Ben Oreskes did a 24-hour shift with those firefighters. And one of the things that stands out in that piece is how much of their day actually has nothing to do with fighting fires, how much of it is just tending to the health needs of the homeless folks. Then you have this enormous fire yesterday in their service radius, and it is the firefighters, veteran firefighters, are saying, like, this is one of the worst things that they've seen. It was burning so hot that it was melting seats in the fire engine across the street. There was an enormous explosion while the firefighters were on the scene. Numerous firefighters had to, like, force their way through that fireball in order to make it out of the building alive. Fortunately, it does seem that everybody did survive. And even though there are some people who are, I think, still in critical condition, I think that they are looking like they're going to survive their injuries. This was a hash oil, hash butane oil, something like that, distributor.
Dabs, right?
Dabs, basically. So they just had, like, thousands upon thousands of bottles of this flammable oil in this place called Smoke Tokes.
Which it actually had smoke in the name of the...
smoke and also, the LA Times is reporting that there was a similar fire that involved the exact same company in an adjacent building just a couple of years ago. And this building that caught fire and eventually exploded yesterday... was damaged during that fire in 2016. So really, really, it was a really horrific scene. You could see this huge, it looked like a bomb went off basically in the middle of downtown. You could see this from miles around, of course. One of the things that I think, as you tipped, Hayes, when we were talking about the Chang guilty plea and the corruption filing from this week, one of the things I couldn't help but think about was the fact that the Los Angeles Department of Building and Safety, which is responsible for permitting buildings, giving them the license to hold these types of materials that are known to be hazardous, making sure that
it turned a building into basically pretty much an enormous lighter, as close to like an actual lighter as you can get. It's like just a container of butane.
Yes.
Just an enormous lighter. And the LADBS has actually been under investigation both currently for corruption and also multiple times over the course of the past decade or so. The FBI has come in and found things like FBI inspectors repeatedly taking bribes, just cash bribes for small dollar amounts in order to just ignore whatever they might find on the premises or not even show up for inspections. There were three different inspectors in the early part of the 2010s who were found to be guilty, eventually pleaded guilty to accepting bribes in lieu of completing their safety inspections. At the
and
time,
you pointed out, Scott, that the person in charge of oversight for a lot of these issues is Ray Chan, who is going to be indicted very soon.
Yeah, yeah. And with almost 100% certainty, Ray Chan, who is an unindicted co-conspirator to the racketeering investigation that we are currently talking about very frequently on this show, he was the person who was at the time deputy director for the department and was put in charge by the general manager of looking into the allegations of corruption. And there were reports at the time that Chan and the other individuals who were supposed to be like keeping an ear to the ground for this sort of bad behavior by inspectors were sweeping it under the rug. And then, you know, when you find out that several years later, he's involved in huge, huge conspiratorial actions to defraud the public, it kind of all starts to make a really grim sort of sense. So personally, I'm looking at this story and I'm wondering, you know, what was the state of this warehouse, the Smoke Tokes warehouse? Was it actually being maintained in such a way that the public safety was that could reasonably have been insured or not? We will get some more information about that, I think, shortly. Federal investigators, particularly the ATF, are going to be arriving to do a thorough investigation as to whether or not this was the product of arson, negligence, or what have you. And they should be here this week, I think. So
I saw a video going around that claimed to be security footage from a nearby building that showed somebody lighting a fire behind the recycle bins, but I have no way of knowing whether or not that was real.
Yeah.
LADBS would also be a good name for a dab shop. What you saw a lot from local elected officials was a lot of, you know, first responder, like firefighter heroism celebration. And of course, it is always like kind of nauseating to watch them do that.
Yep.
But firefighters in LA uniquely have been placed on the front lines of so many life-threatening crises. Now they are basically supervising testing that has like been placed like almost totally under the control of the fire department, the organization of that totally very complex process. They, as we talked about, have been on the front lines of homelessness for many, many years now, actually saving lives dozens of times a day.
Yep.
And to say nothing of the fact that we are at extremely high risk of fires for a huge amount of the year. And that's natural, well, the fires in the natural environment, to say nothing of building fires like this. So it is deserved. It is, like, in LA, being a firefighter is a really tough, dangerous job, and you do stuff that nobody else really wants to do.
There's no question that they deserve all the gratitude and more probably than what they get. You almost, like, looking at something like what happened yesterday, you almost feel like the fire station that is handling Skid Row should not be also handling these other things, right? Like, there are so many health emergencies that they spend all of their time trying to keep people safe in a medical sense, that it's almost unfathomable that they also might have to deal with something like this on no
just
notice.
By the numbers, I mean, how many life-threatening emergency calls came in while they were all tending to this fire?
Right, exactly.
Right.
15, right, 20? Right. Like, it's very horrifying to consider. Let's talk about another public safety department in Los Angeles that has been in the news a lot this week, the LAPD and their interesting relationship with a new law that has been passed in the city. Alyssa, do you want to talk about that?
Is it a law, though? Because that's one thing that has been debated. Are these orders, the order? Well, let's...
Particularly by the police, who have taken the unusual position of saying this is not really a law.
So we had a new order this week, which we'll go in, I think, to more detail of the conflicting types of information that goes into these orders. We had an order from the mayor of the city of Los Angeles.
I think the new order came out on Blue Monday this week.
Blue.
I'm not sure if it was actually Monday. It was around there.
Where you have to wear a face covering anytime you leave the house is what he said. And then they asked Dr. Ferrer the next day, is this actually true? Like, do you wear it even when you are going for a run or a walk by yourself? And she actually said, no, you really only have to wear it when you come into contact with other people. If you're going for a walk or a run by yourself, or if you're by yourself with 6 feet of space around you, you do not have to have it on you unless you plan on interacting with other people. And then that got tossed around again a few times back to the mayor. So it's really not super clear, and it's not super consistent. And you have, again, like the county health department, the city saying different things, although it's supposed to apply for the whole county. It's very, very confusing. But I think the basic thing to know and remember is that you should be using a mask or face covering as a protective device when you are interacting with someone or might get closer than 6 feet to someone by some reason. And then you can be refused service, I think, where you're going to buy groceries or other essential items. And you have to also wear it on Metro now. So we have, and Dash, I think, and all those other types of transit too. So we have something kind of interesting now, is there is something that could be potentially enforceable that we didn't have the week before. And this was something that we had talked about when it was brought up in council. Remember when Koretz put on his bandana, even the homeless have rags or whatever he said, to demonstrate how you could safely just put a piece of cloth over your face. But again, this introduces some problems, again, with enforcement that we've seen in other cities. Specifically in New York City, we saw some pretty intense footage of people being wrestled to the ground. A woman in particular on the subway who had a three-year-old with her, who they pinned on the ground and arrested, you know, because she didn't have her mask on the right way or something like that. I mean, I don't even actually know how you can determine that, because what actually happens in a lot of the situation is the law enforcement officials are not wearing masks themselves, or their masks are pulled down, or they're kind of off to the side, or they're, you know. So first of all, I don't even understand how we get into a point where you can judge how someone is doing a good job with social distancing, in your opinion. We've also seen some things being shared especially in New York, where like parks in Harlem, for example, were, you know, being patrolled and they were telling people to go home and leave. And then there were parks in like down by, you know, the West Village where they were giving out masks to people and saying, oh, just, you know, scoot away. Oh, no problem. And it looks like we're going to have some of those similar problems here because over the last weekend, the beaches were open on a limited basis. You have to be engaging in active movement or an active, I don't know, like a physical activity to be able to the beach. What are you? Are you still can't bike on the
beach path?
The beach path is still closed. Yes. Well, yeah. Okay. That's a whole other issue, but yeah, you have to be moving, but a lot of people were still sitting on the beach. They were had towels out. You could see these drone footage, you know, they were probably keeping good distance between them, but there were a lot of people who were not wearing masks and who were doing what you're not supposed to do based on this order. And we saw this really interesting tweet from Robin Abkarian, who's a columnist for the LA Times, who was on Venice Beach. And she talked to LAPD officers who were looking at the beach, and there were a bunch of people who were sitting, violating the order. And she asked, have you given any citations? And the cop says, no, that would be unconstitutional, like forcing people to wear masks. So also, she didn't note if they had masks on or not. But unconstitutional is an interesting way to present the order that the mayor of your city has.
I mean, there are a lot of MAGA thin blue line people in the LAPD, as Hayes pointed out when you found Corey Palka in Hollywood a couple of years ago.
Excuse me, he was not necessarily a MAGA guy. He was just following dozens and dozens of MAGA accounts,
right,
tracking quote # black thug crime and # Islam is the problem.
Right. But I just want to say, like, the unconstitutionality argument is also interesting because in other parts of the city, there are definitely LAPD who are making arrests for people not following social distancing rules. And maybe it's not happening where Robin Abkarian lives in Venice. But Jasmine Kanick posted video clips that are like things that are happening at Jesse Owens Park in South LA, where just groups of black and brown people are being arrested.
Six people got arrested, and then the LAPD responded to that like, no, it wasn't for not wearing masks. Three of them were arrested for resisting arrest, something that is, of course, epistemologically impossible.
Yeah, and then we have, at the same time, all these videos being posted, which is a very easy thing, whether or not you could determine why somebody is being arrested and what they're being arrested for, because they will always come up with something else, like you said. There's a lot of videos of LAPD officers not wearing masks, and in one case, there's a guy who's in a Chipotle, a cop who's in a Chipotle being like, no, ma'am, we're not wearing masks. We deal with nasty stuff every day. So just a flagrant, I mean, I don't even care. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about arresting people for the wrong reason, but a flagrant disregard for the health and safety of other people that you were supposed to be protecting, when we know that the LAPD has had a lot of cases of coronavirus. Like,
Where's stats guy Michael Moore in all of this? Shouldn't he be able to whip out an Excel chart to explain?
The numbers wonk. The Nate Silver of the LAPD.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like we've seen such a huge misstep in New York in many ways, but like, you know, the mayor is like, don't make us enforce you or we will, kind of this like, you know, ultimatum. And he's been trying to take a hard line, like, we don't make us do this. And it's clear this is going to be going on for a long time with rules that change every week. And you might not even know if you didn't see the news that week and you didn't know that you had to wear a mask or you had to wear one on Metro, or if you couldn't go to the beach and do what someone else is doing and you get caught doing that at the wrong time. I mean, this is just, it's a nightmare, and it's going to continue, especially because we have such confusing, conflicting, overlapping 88 cities and a county health department and one mayor who makes it look like he rules all the cities, but he doesn't. It's really confusing.
Especially when you take into account, like city borders, exactly like what side of the, like whatever, Santa Monica, Venice border you're on. does that change whether you're mandated to wear a mask on this beach or that beach, like depending on what you're doing? It's incredibly confusing.
The thing is, enforcement in the sense of like arrests and citations is not, it just is not appropriate here. And like leading with education, or better yet, like actually helping people get access to these, to like masks and things like that, if they don't have them, and if they don't want to like do what Paul Koretz thinks they should do and like pick up a dirty rag off of the street and cover their face with it, that might also be more helpful than arresting somebody or beating somebody like the cop in Boyle Heights did the other day.
It's possible that they're just getting a recent education on constitutionality from so many of the previous laws that they were enforcing being ruled unconstitutional by federal courts. And so they're like, oh, I've been learning a lot about this document recently, the Constitution. This is my interpretation of it. It's so dark that like those arrests in Jesse Owens Park where they were like, no, we didn't arrest them for not wearing masks. We arrested them for something much pettier. Yeah, right. Some total bullshit. Like, don't worry about that. Scott, we did our emergency episode. We talked about George Chang, real estate consultant, pleading guilty.
Yep.
To a racketeering offense. The short version, what's the one or two sentence version of our emergency episode? And then we can update on some stuff that's happened since then.
Okay, so the really short summary of what we just found out in the federal investigation into city council is that George Chang, who was a real estate consultant and broker in the San Gabriel Valley for many years, was part of a major racketeering scheme with Ray Chan, a former deputy mayor of Eric Garcetti's, and council member Jose Huizar, who was chairing the Plum Committee, that involved a complicated web of kickbacks and bribes, hiring associates, sham contracts, all intended to enrich themselves and get this Lux Hotel redevelopment project in the downtown area in South Park through the planning approvals process with a minimal amount of holdup for the developer. So Chang pled guilty to that charge. And in the immediate aftermath of that, we saw a number of council members come out and say, wow, it seems like Jose Huizar has done some bad things. if you've been listening to this show, of course, we've been talking about this story ever since it first broke back in November of 2018. It's been a year and a half at this point. And a lot of the information that we have in documents like the one that just came out in the Chang case are mostly corroborations of things that we already knew from previous documents.
Which is what is so stupid about these council members just now en masse, or not all of them, but something like half of them now have come forward and said at like in unison that Jose Huizar should resign.
What are the other half of them?
Is it all half?
For?
Yeah, is it a full half? That's what I was wondering.
It might
too.
Not even be half. I saw six.
I don't even think it's half.
And even some of them did it in like steps where like, well, they saw what the other ones were willing to do. Where like, I know David Rue at first was like, well, if he knows he's guilty in his heart, then he should resign. And then that became after Bob Blumenfeld and some others said that he straight up should resign, then he jumped on board and like, you know, it was this little like each of them like kind of tiptoeing like to see
Blumenfeld. So Blumenfeld and Rue, following the announcement in the Kim case, which was the second of our three, Justin Kim was another real estate consultant who pled guilty to corruption charges related to Jose Huizar. After that case, Bob Blumenfeld of District 3 in the Southwest San Fernando Valley, and David Rue of Council District 4, who's under pressure from a challenger in a runoff race, they were the two that came out and said, this is bad. This council member should maybe not be voting. Now, following the third one, we've added a few new voices to that, including Council President Nuri Martinez. Martinez came out this past week after the Chang guilty plea was announced, and she said that Huizar should stay away from council. She was basically like, just don't show up. Don't come.
Collect your paycheck.
Yeah. Stay at home. Collect your paycheck. If anybody else wants to pay you for anything else, you know, maybe just coast until it's time.
It's like, well, I'm not voting anymore. There's no conflict. now you're mad.
Huizar, he said he would try to stay away as much as possible from city council, but he thinks it's important that he continues to provide a voice for CD14 where and when he can. So that's kind of the state of this case, or the state of city council right now. The LA Times editorial board came out with they were the ones who broke the story about Nuri Martinez in the first place, but they came out with an uncharacteristically strong statement about Jose Huizar, saying basically he should be off of city council immediately. That seemed to mark the point at which a number of other city council members came out and said that they felt like their offices were being tainted by the continued presence of Jose Huizar on city council, which, yeah, that's kind of obvious.
But I feel crazy pointing this out, but this is one of two active FBI investigations in the business of a council member right now. One of two that we know of.
Yeah.
The other seems to clearly implicate Council District 12 council member John Lee in a scheme to cover up rampant bribery for the council member at the time, Mitch Englander, who he was the chief of staff for and went to Vegas with. And received many of the same benefits from these people that wanted Mitch Englander's favor. How many sitting council members have said one word about John Lee's case?
I actually don't think that anybody has.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has.
Is none council member.
None council
truly
member.
Truly a unanimous decision, though, so that
yes.
shouldn't surprise
yeah,
us.
Another
yeah,
another unanimous decision.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that city council has held the opinion that if the public is not sufficiently pissed off about it, that they demonstrate their anger in, like, for example, in John Lee's case, since we were deprived of the opportunity to know about this before the election, it would have to come in the form of like a recall, right? That would have to happen following the new year in 2021. And city council members have basically held the belief that unless the citizenry goes to these extreme lengths to clean up City Hall themselves, it's yep. all fair game. Whatever happens, it needs to be adjudicated by the voters or else it's like it didn't happen.
It is still funny to me that at no time have we heard Jose Huizar say, like, I didn't do any of this? Has he ever gone and said, like, this is all a misunderstanding, even that I'm innocent? I guess he's never, and that would, I guess, involve admitting that he is the person being investigated in these cases, even though he hasn't been named in any of the guilty pleas yet. But, like,
he has been completely mum.
Yes.
For years at this point. I mean, and his lawyers aren't saying anything either. The interesting thing is the original raids that happened in Jose Huizar's office and at his house, that was in November of 2018, right? So so at that point in time, when we got the news about the other individuals that were subjects of this investigation, including Joel Jacinto, a former commissioner for the Board of Public Works, he was reached out to for comment by the LA Times, and he was like, I've never heard of any of this. I haven't been contacted by the FBI. All of these people, like Jacinto, we haven't heard a word from them since early 2019. Yep. I mean, I don't think that any of them are going to say a word about this for the duration until they settle whatever pleas they're eventually going to try and take with the FBI. George Chang signed his original cooperating plea agreement actually in December of 2018, even though the information is just coming out now. So, yeah, it's all behind the scenes right now.
These people haven't said anything in public because they're all just like talked out from talking to the FBI all day, every single day. They're just, you know, like some days you're just like, oh, I'm just kind of all talked out from rolling up on my superiors. We didn't even put this on the schedule, but an important thing that happened this week. Speaking of November 2018, that was when Katie Hill was elected to Congress for her short-lived term. She was the election, the special election to replace her was this past Tuesday. Christy Smith, the Democrat, running against Mike Garcia, the Republican. More votes are going to come in and it'll get a little bit closer, but Christy Smith has already conceded. I think it was a much more decisive victory for Mike Garcia, the Republican, than anyone was expecting. What did the two of you attribute that victory for him?
My thought is that special elections are always going to be problematic, and it's a great idea to try to trap people into situations where they have to resign, and then you can always win the special election. I mean, it was a calculated move, and it worked.
Right. Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's no other way to, like...
It was a calculated move, and it did work. I mean, there was an extreme wild card in the form of the global pandemic that... I mean, how do you even... You're seeing these images of elections that are taking place since California's primary election in other states. Obviously, we did a better job of preparing than places like Wisconsin did in the recent past. But still, like, if you're at home and you're like, it's a special election anyway, it's below most people's radar. How do you gin up any sort of, like, giving a shit about a special congressional election? It's hard. It's hard.
Unless you're someone who wants the government to reopen as soon as possible, and you just go out and vote because it's part of your daily activities of protesting.
You would vote normally.
Right. And they did have outdoor voting. Did you see? How they had it set up, like, in the street and in parking lots? Al fresco. I thought that was kind of amazing. That's probably why we're going to have to vote in November if, you know, people don't take advantage of the vote by mail. But of course, people are going to go out and not be afraid because they are already think that there's no virus. Sure.
I mean, it's kind of like the story that we talked about last week in relation to this was national media saying, you know, that this is going to be the first time in over 20 years that a Democratic seat has flipped to Republican. Other than being a sort of eye-catching headline, I don't really feel like there's much here that's worrisome. It seems like it's clearly an outlier. Alyssa's totally right. Like, the special election electorate is different than the primary and the general electorate in the state of California. This was a concerted effort by right-wing actors in the state to try and force a more favorable condition for them to win an election, and it worked. But, like, unless we're talking about, like, oh no, our streak is over in the state, like, it's kind of not the most consequential election.
I think it's something like a 9-point differential now between Smith and Garcia. That'll probably narrow to maybe like 5 or 6 or something, which does seem surmountable in a November 2020 election where turnout will be much higher. I did see those outdoor voting locations also had signs that said, this is not a virus testing facility. Just to add to...
We're using a lot of tents for a lot of different things right now. We just can't really, you know, we have to sort them out.
The images that, had you seen them 3 months ago, been like, oh, that doesn't seem very much fun to live through. So there this week on the issue of confusion over some edicts from the L.A. city and county, the L.A. Times reported that Barbara Ferrer, the county public health director for Los Angeles, told the county board of supervisors that the safer at home order, the county's shelter in place order, will, with all certainty, in quotes, be in effect through the end of July.
Yeah.
And
I think people actually reported it as August. They just said straight up August too. Like, that's just adding to the confusion. They were like, until August.
They said into August.
Yeah, into August. Yeah.
Yes. And people completely lost their shit.
Yep.
And it forced Garcetti to go on Anderson Cooper 360 and be like, wow, freak out much?
This,
like,
this is, okay. I mean, not really a great message to put out when now every single person in your city of 4 million has multiple group text chains where they just post like,
yeah,
this is my life now, and they're eating, I don't know, 2 pounds of pasta over the stove or whatever. There are a lot of sad people right now, and you probably shouldn't test the limits of that.
Garcetti said, yes, this was
Scott
the line
is
that I
drinking. I just want to point out that it is his birthday.
It's his birthday.
And we
birthday.
Are on a Zoom chat and he's drinking. Is that like a Cosmo martini?
It's frozen.
Is it frozen?
It's a tequila sour.
A tequila
sour. Wow. Dirty 30, Scott Frazier.
Yeah, Jennifer Garner, 30 and flirty and thriving. That's
it was just the perfect like end to that statement. He was like,
my favorite line from Garcetti to Anderson Cooper 360 was, it's important not to overreact and not to underreact. What's important?
Wow.
It's just a middle react. He said, not to overreact today when there were huge headlines on CNN and the LA Times when our county health officer merely said an order would stay in place at least 3 more months. That does not mean the order stays in place exactly as it is today. But of course, that means we're still going to protect our vulnerable and our seniors. We're still going to need to wear facial coverings. We're still going to need to physically distance. So that almost seems to promise that the restrictions that are in place right now will be loosened over the next couple months,
right,
even though right now we don't have a lot of indications, really any, that the restrictions in place right now are crushing the curve as much as they are flattening it. This week, last week and the week before that, we had an average of 40-something deaths every single day. The number of cases, as we've talked about in past weeks, has risen a lot. The number of new cases being caught, that has mostly happened along with huge increases in testing. But there are people still getting cases by the thousands every single day in Los Angeles. I want to talk about a couple things related to this announcement. There was an article today in the LA Times about how Latino service workers bear the brunt of coronavirus. That's the headline. The lead is about a woman named Lupe Martinez who does laundry at a Riverside nursing home who was faced with the choice of going to work and risking getting coronavirus or losing her paycheck and not being able to get unemployment insurance because she quit her job. She decided to go to work as hundreds of thousands of other people are being forced to do around LA County, and she got coronavirus. And so did her husband, who has a heart condition, and so did both of her children. And this is happening all over the county, like the entire region. We saw this week that two cashiers at different Ralph's stores have died in the last couple weeks. Neither of those was at the Rock and Roll Ralph's, which experienced an outbreak of 21 cases. I know, like, I've heard like a few people kind of souring on the clapping for essential workers, but like now every single night at 8 p.m. it is like kind of hard for me to listen to because we have created conditions where people were, just by virtue of the job that they happen to have, were drafted into a war. We call them frontline workers. But like they were unlucky enough to be working in an industry that we decided was worth it, was more worth it for them to just keep doing their jobs, not be allowed to leave and collect unemployment insurance, where they might have been actually making more than they were making at the store. They have to stay working. They have to put themselves in danger every single day. I'm sure they would much rather just collect unemployment than go through this nightmare for 8 hours a day, every single day, without effective protective equipment in most cases. We just decided to keep sending them to work without taking the necessary precautions. We could have done things at grocery stores, been like every single, we could have done curbside pickup only at every grocery store. We could have said, like, give us your order. Do not come into the store. We will process it for you, as they're doing right now for people that don't wear masks. We could have done that for everyone and just, like, reduce the number of contacts that people were being forced to make. We could have done, like, set up a home delivery system for people. Like,
I mean, and you look at other countries. I was just trying to find some of the data, the latest data on what other countries have done and succeeded. Mm-hmm. And you look at places like Canada, where you got, like, everybody got like $2,000 a month in Canada for the duration of the crisis, in addition to having healthcare already mm-hmm. taken yes. care of on top of it. And you look at even what a lot of other countries did as far as just like freezing their economy and saying, okay, we're going to do this for a few weeks and then we'll bring you back. And even in a place like California, LA, places that where we have like a lot of labor awareness, like of how to take care of people who are in these jobs, and we have unions that are very powerful, we still had none of these things in place. And I just have to wonder, when is someone, and we still have everything focused on like these conversations about, oh, what's next? What happens next? This is like the crisis. This is the crux yeah. of the crisis right now. And we don't need to be talking about like, oh, what happens when we go back to our offices? Ooh, like, how am I going to get to my office? That is not the issue. The issue is, like you said, these people who have been on the front lines, who we have ignored. And now we are, and now we're like, oh, they're getting sick. Are we surprised that cases continue to stay high and deaths and hospitalizations like all are continuing to happen? It's because we're forcing this to happen in one of the most progressive states in the country.
There's so much like public shaming going on about like people jogging without masks yes. and things like that, and being like, oh, that's why the spread
Who
is
cares?
Still happening.
Yes, that's not it.
Could it also be because behavior that we have sanctioned and encouraged all the way through, which is just like going to the grocery store and having someone stand there and touch people's possessions as hundreds of mouths pass before them every single day? Like, that's something we said from the beginning was just allowed to happen. And a lot of people have died because of that decision. It's not just in LA, it's everywhere in the country, but we should have
but
protected
we know
people better.
Better. Yeah, we yeah. know better.
I mean, honestly,
places.
One of the things that I feel like has to be taken into account here is that in California, we're a wealthy state. We are a very wealthy state, but we're a state where the employment, the composition of the labor workforce is so stratified by race in particular yeah. and by geography as well. That's how you end up with a place like San Francisco.
Yep.
Essentially taming this disease in a matter of weeks, where their workforce almost entirely consists of people who are white or Asian. They're working office jobs that they can easily do remotely, and they're incredibly wealthy. They have means that the majority of Americans don't have. By contrast, the city is full of these service industry jobs. San Francisco is. And those are being filled by Black and brown workers who are coming in from elsewhere, whose lives are being put at stake. And then they go back yeah. home and they spread it in their communities. And we're seeing similar things take place in Los Angeles, where we have we've had these protests where they're like white people basically saying, I'm bored. Like, we need to do something because I don't know how to fill up my time. And, you know, and then that actually moves the needle, and the mayor and the governor start saying, okay, well, I guess we need to accelerate our reopening plan. In the meantime, you have the largely non-white workforce in Los Angeles getting sick and being asked to put themselves in more danger with each passing week just to accommodate wealthier, whiter people.
That's the subtext. All the gloating in San Francisco about how low their numbers are is basically celebrating the fact that they exiled their service workers already
right.
across
isn't
the
it,
border.
Yes. Isn't it just because the city is so rich that they have forced people to have these super long commutes just to get to their jobs. And now those people aren't counted in their...
It doesn't count in their...
I mean, that is the quintessential like dystopian scenario in this. And then they're getting praised for it in the national media, right?
It would basically be like if the quadrant to the northwest of the 10 and the 405, Brentwood and Santa Monica and whatever, were all just their own city. And then they could say, hey, look how great we're doing with this disease.
We did it. We crushed the curve in Los Angeles. Oh, like, oh, that Westmont or whatever. They must not be wearing their masks. Yeah, it's grim. A couple things in the stats that I do want to focus on. One is we did, I forget if it was this week or late last week, but set the milestone of more than 50% of deaths in LA County have been in, quote, institutional settings, with the vast majority of those being skilled nursing facilities, like nursing, like senior care facilities. And also the other statistic that I have been trying to figure out is hospitalizations have been going way down. Not like new hospitalizations have been very low. They're in the like 50s or 60s every day. They're like pretty actually close to the number of deaths, which is pretty shocking. And the number of people who are currently hospitalized has also been falling, but deaths have not. So why are hospitalizations falling and deaths aren't? My theory is that deaths are, or like people that are put in some kind of like urgent care situation at a nursing home are not counted as hospitalizations. And so many, many people who are dying in those facilities, which we now know is more than half of deaths in LA County, never registered as a hospitalization. They never got moved into a different facility. So many of these nursing homes have like what are basically ICU beds, like long-term care beds. And I asked Claudia Pasciuta at Reporter Claudia with KNX if she had the numbers on this, and she said that she would ask on my behalf. So I'll be able to report back, thanks to her, next week. Let's talk about the Crenshaw line. This is refreshing. Just like basic delays and...
Honestly, the Crenshaw line is in an interesting state right now. This is the light rail line that is being constructed for Metro Los Angeles. It's going to run between the Expo Line, Exposition Boulevard, south past LAX, eventually with a connection to the airport there and connecting up with the existing Green Line. That is now 2 years delayed, but the news story that we had come out this week reported from some committee documents by Twitter user at Numble, who is always very good about posting these online, is that Metro is very likely going to proceed with a new grade separation project on the Crenshaw line that will result in a 2-year bus bridge in the middle of the Crenshaw line shortly after it actually opens, which right now is projected to be sometime next year. So there's a particular crossing where the Crenshaw line that's under construction right now is going through Centinela. And Mayor James Butts in Inglewood, who is also currently the chair of the Metro Board, has been fighting, as we've talked about on here, to get a bunch of professional sports arenas situated in his city. Now that that's mostly accomplished, he is looking at this Crenshaw line and saying, okay, now we're going to have all of this car traffic from the stadium, so we need to elevate the light rail line over Centinela so that we're not causing delay on either the train or the cars. Mm. Now, on top of the delays that the Crenshaw line already has 2 years to open, because of that, there are about $100 million in extra construction costs that Metro needs to figure out a way to pay for. And they have tried to accomplish that by going to some of these like local South Bay cities and saying, would you be willing to chip in some money to do this? And they have basically said, yeah, we will do it, but we want to make sure that you do the Centinela grade or over above grade crossing. You're going to build that bridge over Centinela, And you're going to do it in such a way that there's going to be a full shutdown of the Crenshaw line between these two points, where somebody is going to have to basically get on the train, get off the train, get onto a bus, get off the bus, and then get back onto the Crenshaw line in order to move in a straight line. And that's going to last for 23 months. So Metro has done, I would say, what you could charitably describe as a worst case scenario job with the Crenshaw line from start to finish. This latest news is really just kind of like the icing on the cake, especially when you take into account that when that bus bridge is done, there's probably going to be another one for the people mover to the airport. So if you are a Crenshaw line rider, I weep for you, I guess, is that could be a segment. I weep for you.
Should be the name of the show. I mean, you know, it makes sense. One thing, if you're a planner right now, the thing you want to be primarily focused on is tens of thousands of people going to sporting events. The one thing we know for sure that we will need to plan for is huge numbers of people gathering at stadiums. That will definitely happen. There's no way they will start up the NFL too quickly and a player dies of coronavirus and the next two seasons are canceled. And now instead of just an empty train running to and from this stadium, there will be an empty bus as well. Yes. Let's talk about, boy, Judge Carter continues to put out banger after banger.
He is a true hero. He is feeling a true himself. Hero of this.
This is
pandemic.
The Carter Five or something like that. federal judge has issued an order. Must feel very cool to be an activist in this courtroom right now, because like you just go to this guy and be like, "This, look at this shit, it's fucked up," and he's like, "Yeah, like let's you have a week to completely undo this
atrocity
this week." What was it, Alyssa?
So he issued an order. For a little bit of background on the case, Judge Carter has been the same judge that ordered the movement of, I think it was 1,000 people out of the Santa Ana River bed in the OC, and said you basically have to house these people. And it led to this big settlement where a bunch of cities built shelters, a bunch of those, they kind of like moved them into a bunch of places and got people to kind of, a lot of cities to take responsibility for what was happening, which was really good. He's now focused on LA's problem in a different case. And you've seen over the last week, things like hand washing stations. He's been out there himself, like testing the hand washing stations. He's asked the city and county to come back to him a few times with ideas for getting people off the streets as soon as possible. He's talked about hotels. They've talked about all these different solutions. And one of the orders he issued on this case, which is ongoing, was that anyone who was living under or near a freeway would have to be moved, relocated, housed humanely within a week's time, which would be next Friday, May 22nd by noon. So this is a substantial order, most of all because, I mean, that's where the problem really is as far as like unsheltered people in the city, in this county. I mean, most of the people have kind of been pushed so far to the margins of our society that it's in these places that are super dangerous. He specifically cited things like lead poisoning, other toxins, that you'd be more likely to die by being hit by a car or if there was an earthquake and say like a bridge fell down. So he said it was like a very dangerous place to live and we should make sure as soon as possible that people don't live there. And what was interesting too about the ruling was that he issued it and that night Mayor Garcetti had a show. He only has his shows on like particular days now, but I tune in every time. And he said, someone asked him about this, a reporter asked him, and the mayor said, there is no order to do this. He legitimately flat out, yes, there is an order. And I think what he was trying to say was, we can talk the judge into a, like a different deal or something like that and not have to do this.
which probably will happen. Although, given this guy lately,
this judge Carter, I don't know. Judge Carter is kind of a big deal.
So he is on one.
I think there's two things to talk about here. One is, and I think this was something, Hayes, you wanted to talk about. If we wanted to, say, move everybody into shelters, for example, or these temporary shelters that we've made, these emergency shelters, there's no capacity because of the pandemic right now, right? Like, there's no... They're all full. And
there hasn't really been for over a month.
Yeah.
They filled up almost instantly. These rec centers that we turned into emergency shelters, we said that we were going to be able to house 6,000 plus people in them. And then it occurred to the people organizing this process that they actually needed to not be packed in like sardines, because this is a pandemic. They needed to be given a just like totally nominal 6 feet of separation for their beds. And so they only ended up putting somewhere in like the low thousand, like, you know,
I think it's not even 1,000 technically.
Not even 1,000.
Yeah, not even 1,000. That could change.
Yes. But not only are they not, so they are not accepting new clients, period, for this program going forward in anticipation of closing these shelters. That is
right.
What,
I mean, I think that's the other thing, right? So these are temporary. When the other order, the safer at home order ends, for example, these people will need to be housed. And it was another promise of the mayor that once we got people inside, they wouldn't go back on the streets. So we have the hotel option, which we've talked about before, would be a great time to get all 15,000 of those rooms online and make sure we can move everybody as we, you know, promised we would do into a safe place. This, I think, also kind of counts as one of the most vulnerable groups. If you are been exposed to brake dust for the last few months or years of your life, I mean, that would definitely put you at a health risk to contract COVID-19. But the bigger question, I think, is so, again, like our fractured city and all these overlapping jurisdictions. The city does not own the land around, above, or next to freeways.
Mm-hmm.
Caltrans owns that. And I think the number that was pulled was like something like there's like, you know, 900 miles of the number that was pulled by Jenna Chandler at Curbed LA. There's like 900 miles of state and federal owned highways and freeways in our county that are not up to us. And especially when you talk to people who are working as caseworkers or advocates, the answer you will get for almost anything that you ask for to help people who are living around freeways is that the city has nothing to do with that. Yes. Mm-hmm. So my question is, and I think a lot of other people are asking this, why isn't Caltrans responsible for this? Why aren't we making them do this? Because it seems like that surely this is kind of, if their problem, their property, and it seems like that's something that they should be taking care of.
I hesitate to put any of the responsibility onto that garbage department, one of the worst agencies in government in the United States. But I mean, to me, this whole order is pretty psychotic. Judge Carter needs someone who can like be honest with him. It, like, to like tell him no every once in a while, because the fact that there are thousands and thousands of people living under overpasses in LA is the product of, I mean, like the level of disinvestment extends to the beginning of the incorporation of Los Angeles. It's like a century-long process of not creating shade for people to like stay out of the elements. That has been totally deliberate, that the only shade that we have created in Los Angeles is for cars to pass over other cars. It's incidental shade where that we accidentally created, and they have deliberately, the city, removed other shade opportunities for people to sleep under, to shovel them under the highways. I went to a Central Hollywood Neighborhood Council meeting where an aide to a city council member was celebrating the fact that the office had been having the tree trimmers trim back shade in places where people were camping out to expose them to the sun and the rain so they would have to move along. It is 100% deliberate, and you have people in city government admitting that they've done this intentionally. You cannot undo this in a week. The only way to do it would be like forcible removal that will be incalculably dramatic for people.
I think the other thing too is there wasn't any specifics about how close to the freeway you yeah. are if you're in danger, and not even really any other language about what kind of dwelling. I mean, there's a lot of people who live in like RVs, things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, do they get to stay? So by this reasoning, we should not have anybody living next to freeways in any type of housing, even if it's your house
right.
that was there. And then the other thing is, if you're really that worried about people getting hit by vehicles that are going fast through our cities, wouldn't this extend to anybody who lives near even a wide road or a dangerous road? As we've seen in the past, like, people have been hit by cars while they've been sleeping in their tents and have been mm-hmm. killed in other parts of the city. So the only way to fix this problem is to tear down all the freeways and to make
that
sure
is
that
the
we
only
move
way
to
do
zero
it.
Emission Wait. Transportation.
That, I mean, come on, Judge Carter.
By next Friday, by Friday.
I
Friday
know.
At noon.
You,
Friday at noon, they're all going down.
No,
nobody's,
I mean, like,
driving on them. It's fine. This is a good time to do this.
If the city were made to, so the, by the way, the only thing that I really object to with this is that it is a forced removal, that you, that they are making people that live under and near the freeways leave. They have to give them an option of somewhere to go, which will inevitably be a communal, like a group shelter, not like an individual room, which that is, you know, you talk about service resistance. A person who's homeless, almost no person who's living on the street would turn down a room, like a motel room or with their own bathroom
right.
or whatever.
Yes.
A group shelter? Yeah. A lot of people
of
are going to turn that down. And also those shelters aren't going to be available anyway. So if it were just saying, hey, you, since you live near this area, you have the option of moving into this space. And if they say no, they say no. And you will end up with a lot of people saying yes and wanting to move somewhere else. But the fact that it's forced is a nightmare. I am gratified in this one case that the inertia of the city will cause it to never happen. Certainly not by Friday. Garcetti is right in that response. There might as well be no order because there is absolutely no way they will be able to accomplish this, especially since they are primarily occupied right now with contesting an earlier ruling that a different judge declared some of anti-homelessness policies in the city of LA unconstitutional. In this case, we talked about it at the time the ruling went through. A judge declared that the rule that the city of LA has against people who are homeless having bulky items, basically any item that all items that wouldn't fit in a 60-gallon bag, which is like a large garbage bag, are able to be seized by the Bureau of Street Services and put in a trash compactor. A judge declared that unconstitutional, says that you can't, actually, I think explicitly said some variation on, like, you can't discriminate against bulky items just for them being bulky. And the city, once again, instead of taking the L, is taking it up to a higher court. They are using the money that we claim not to have right now for any social purpose to pay for Mike Feuer, the city attorney's office, to take this ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Something I think is relevant about this is the city council couldn't even agree that this was a good idea. It was an 11-4 ruling at the beginning of the pandemic to continue confiscating bulky items. And it was Mike Bonin, Herb Wesson, Marquise Harris Dawson, and Gil Cedillo said that they should not continue confiscating bulky items. So even the city council, like, four members of the city council think that we should stop carrying out this policy. And yet somehow it's been decided that it's worth Los Angeles's time to continue fighting this case in federal court
at this moment, at this time, right now. I mean,
This is the kind of thing that we were talking about in relationship to the protections for tenants that got held up and significantly watered down in city council at the start of the crisis. This is exactly what was meant by the fact that the city attorney picks politically the battles that it wants to engage in. City attorney Mike Feuer has repeatedly come down hard against homeless residents of this city. Mm-hmm. And he, despite, like you said, despite them losing so many mm-hmm. of these cases on constitutionality grounds in so many different ways and in so many different arenas, they have not lost their appetite for this particular battle. They don't want to do basically anything that would improve the lives of the homeless or that would improve the lives of tenants writ more generally. But yeah, when it comes to just like recriminating against the people who are living on the streets in Los Angeles, they never miss an opportunity to lose big.
That's Mike Feuer's. This is his like mayoral campaign, like his persistence. Nevertheless, he persisted.
That's going to be his tagline.
And this, by the way, I thought like in my head, like I was conflating them. I thought this was a Judge Carter ruling too. It was not. This was a different federal judge, Dale Fisher, that made the ruling against the bulky item ban. That is it for the show this week. We have a very exciting race going on the LA Podcast Patreon, patreon.com/LA Podcast. In the poll for the next movie that we talk about for 30 Mile Zone, the bonus show where we talk about every movie that's ever been made about Los Angeles. Currently, with 90 votes in, there are 33 for Mulholland Drive and 29 for Magnolia. Would any co-host like to make their case for someone, if they haven't voted yet, possibly haven't subscribed yet, to help support local journalism, because we are putting our revenue towards commissioning stories? That's already happening. It's very exciting. We have a lot of fun stuff in the works. Would anyone like to make a case for a certain movie?
I wanted to give it first a shout out to Hayes, who's been curating these. And I don't know if any of us has been paying attention, but this one is Sunset Boulevard, Mulholland Drive, Magnolia, and Laurel Canyon. So this is the Great Streets edition of the... of the voting. But I have not seen Mulholland Drive, and I don't want to particularly see it. So if there's any way we can avoid that, you know who to vote for, friends.
It is. So I don't know how you feel about this, Alyssa. It's a great LA, a lot of great LA locations. It's one of my favorite movies. I don't watch a lot of scary movies, but it has the most terrifying moment of any movie that I have ever seen.
I know. So that's the thing. I already know enough about it, and I don't like scary movies, so I don't really want to see it. And I don't want to be subjected to that during the pandemic.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I just want to say reverse psychology is always a good strategy with internet voters. I don't know if you should broadcast that you don't want to watch something that loudly.
Right now, just a few votes behind. Magnolia is great. Magnolia would be really fun, too. But it's up to the listeners.
It's up to you. Our it's up to gods. You, people. What do you want us to do?
Check out our episode of our other bonus show, The 10 with Alex Cohen, which is available on the Patreon now. That one was really fun. She talked about living next to a leather bar and all that comes with that. Before we go, I just want to say we were so honored to find out a couple days ago that a professor at SUNY Geneseo, Professor Beth McCoy, teaching a class called Expulsion and the Housing Crisis, has been assigning LA podcasts for students to listen to. And actually, the final assignment of the course was for students to consider Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, Octavia Butler, Pasadena's Own, alongside episodes of LA Podcast that they have been listening to throughout the semester. I mean, I just like cannot tell you how blown away we are to hear this and to read these essays. We'll link to them on our Twitter, but they are absolutely incredible. And we are so touched that this is something that these students have been doing all semester. And I want to thank all the students, sorry for pronouncing any names wrong, Thank you to Micah Ambrose, Megan Anders, Jessica Apthorpe, Sandy Brosbat, Molly Byrne, Alice Chen, Sandra Ching, Madison Edmond, Emilio Garcia, Issa Higgins, Tessa Hensler, Christian Lanzetta, Makara Lisicki, Courtney Lyon, Melissa Maliniak, Laura Mangino, Caitlin McNulty, Ian Oxman, Maria Pappas, Elena Ritz, Corinne Scanlon, Amanda Sheps, Emily Soy, Stephanie Wall, and Andrew Weber. I really hope that people do look at our social media and check out these essays that are absolutely fantastic, and you really honor us by listening to the show and doing this. We're so thrilled, and we will be back next week on LA Podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye. LA Podcast gonna have